From the news centre at 5, police say that they're not ruling out revenge as a link between the murder of a man in Leicester and the nearby house fire which killed 4 people. A man in his 20s was seriously assaulted yesterday and later died in hospital. A few hours later, a woman and her 3 teenage children were murdered in a house fire. Here's Assistant Chief Constable Roger Bannister from Leicestershire Police.
An element of revenge is just one of many lines of inquiry that's being looked at. I'm not confirming here and now that revenge is taking place. It's something that we'll investigate.
4 men convicted of raping and murdering a woman in India have been sentenced to death. They lured the 23-year-old woman and her male friend onto a bus in New Delhi last December. A court official's been jailed for 6 years after helping more than 70 motorists avoid driving bans and penalty points. David Kelly, who's 47 and worked for Liverpool Magistrates Court, was found guilty of changing DVLA records. There are calls for the Bank of England to cap house price rises in order to prevent a bubble in the property market. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors wants yearly house price inflation limited to 5%. But Miles Shipside from the property website Rightmove thinks the government's flagship Help to Buy scheme will help calm the market.
We've got a growing number of households, we've got immigration into the country, so demand is there for housing and we need to provide more supply. And ironically, Help to Buy may well help a lot of trapped sellers trade up, and that will release more supply as well.
Twitter is heading for a stock market flotation, with analysts suggesting the company's worth around £6 billion. The micro-blogging site is keen to persuade advertising firms of its growing penetration of the mobile market, and Twitter will want to avoid a repeat of Facebook's disastrous float last year after their share price languished for a long time. And Voyager 1 spacecraft has become the first man-made object to leave our solar system. It was launched 36 years ago. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Assad and the Armageddon option. We hear an extract from Charlie Rose's CBS interview with Boogeyman, President Assad himself. Also, have secret societies been planning world wars for centuries as part of a plan to dominate the world? Well, sounds far-fetched. So we have a look at the letter believed to have been sent in the mid-1800s from American Freemason Albert Pike to Italian Mason Giovanni Mazzini. Also, as Germany splashes out to restore the Nuremberg Stadium, we continue our discussion last week looking at Hitler's place where he held his famous rallies and ask, what were the rallies really all about? And is it a good way to spend £30 million to restore it? Plus, Martin Summers' tour of the world's hotspots in our second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius, some heavy showers. This weekend, highs of 16, fairly cloudy with showers, windier on Sunday and more sunny on Saturday. Next week, highs of 16 again, wetter and windier at the beginning of the week, slightly sunnier towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 21st, 22nd of September, highs of 16, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Redland, Fee Hance. Hi, Fee, and welcome to Drive Time. Now, I know you had a meeting of the full council this week. You mentioned it just now. Give us an idea of how these meetings work. Every single councillor is there, is that right?
Pretty much, yes. That's one of the few completely obligatory meetings that councillors have to go to. They have to go once every 6 months. Everything else is actually technically optional. The problem with full council, of course, is that it's very much stage managed for the media. Mostly in all the other meetings that you attend as a councillor with other party members from different parties, you tend to thrash things out in a reasonable fashion. You come to a conclusion. And generally, they're quite civilised affairs. For the problem with full council, of course, is that it's very confrontational, it's very adversarial. It's actually one of my least favourite aspects of being a councillor. I mean, fortunately, it only happens once every 2 months or so, but It is the longest, in this case, 5.5 hours of my life. Admittedly, you get a free sandwich in the middle, but that is pretty much the high point, as far as I'm aware.
OK, so why is this such an exciting event for the media? Because surely most of the big decisions are farmed out to various committees. They're not necessarily made at the full council, are they?
No, they're not made at the full council, pretty much. That's what makes the whole city... I mean, since you bring the subject of full council up, for me... And I know that my view is shared by quite a number of councillors across the political spectrum. They are a bit of a farce. Somebody once stood up at a budget meeting a couple of years ago. It was a young woman who stood up and said, "This is an effing pantomime." And I thought, yeah, I think you're about right there, madam.
So because when you say it's stage managed, what do you mean by that?
Well, decisions are made outside of the council chamber. Pretty much everybody, I mean, not entirely, but pretty much everybody follows their whip's directions. I think the Greens are an exception, but there are only four of them even now. So decisions are made as to how you're going to vote outside of the meeting, and you are there simply to press a button and say aye. All the confrontational arguments, all the insults, all the name-calling, it is entirely atypical of the way that councillors behave outside of the chamber, and that's what I find so very frustrating about it. I mean, you may know I've only actually stood up and said something twice in full council in my entire career, 4 years as a councillor, simply for the very reason that I really, really despise the confrontational nature.
So you think there's too much squabbling, and you don't personally want to get involved in those squabbles?
I think it's simply to, as far as I can tell, it appears to be to create headlines for the Evening Post and for the BBC, because they like a nice confrontational so-called debate. It's not really a debate at all half the time. It's name-calling and insults. And even when there is broad agreement on a subject, it is astonishing how so often, out of agreement, that conflict arises for no apparent reason. It's the opposite of what Thatcher said when she got elected. What was it? I can't remember the quote now. It's Francis of Assisi. But you know, even where people agree, they manage to dredge up some ancient political squabble from years ago, and they will dredge it up and they'll bring it up.
Well,
and
a lot of people that don't vote would quote exactly what you've been saying. It's one of the reasons that they don't vote is that actually much of what's going on at these full council meetings, the squabbling as you call it, is really superficial. It's about issues that don't really necessarily matter much.
The issues people are squabbling about are often very, very important. It's the squabbling that I find difficult. And that's another reason.
So give us an idea of what was being squabbled about and discussed and argued on Tuesday.
The under-occupancy charge, the bedroom tax, that was a case in point.
What do you call it?
Well, I call it the both? I personally call it the bedroom tax, because that's what everyone calls it, let's be honest here. You have to call a spade a spade. Again, I mean, the mayor, quite reasonably, I think, said go away. He gave councillors 5-6 months to come to some conclusions about it. A report was produced and brought back to council, and immediately the squabble started again. So it appeared that councillors, in this instance, were incapable of producing something that they agreed on, and there was.
This working group has been looking at the bedroom tax.
The mayor did describe it as being a farce, and for once, you know, I'm with the mayor on this one, because it was farcical. Nobody's minds were changed. Everybody became more entrenched. There were one or two people, notably Pete Levy, who stood up and made a non-party political point. I think Peter Hammond actually made a fairly reasonable speech as well, just to even things up. But a lot of the discussion was around the Labour Party said this, you Lib Dems said that, you Tories said the other, and I don't think it's helpful. And as I said, it gives a very, very misleading impression of the way that councillors work, because we don't do that. Outside of the council chamber, councillors don't do that. I guess I'm very well and have good personal and working relationships with people from other political parties. Shocking as it may seem, you know, some of them are quite reasonable. And outside of the council chamber, we often agree to disagree. We respect each other's opinions, but you don't get that in the chamber because it's being televised. And it's one of the things I really feel very passionate about, because I just think it's so misleading. And people look at that and just think, why should I vote? And I can't blame them. If they saw the way we worked elsewhere, such as in neighbourhood partnerships or pretty much any other meeting you care to mention, we work well and we work pretty efficiently and we come to conclusions based on our differing views. Okay, but full council is that one showpiece where people seem to want to ape Parliament and those parliamentary debates that we all know are also, you know, productive and wonderful.
Prime Minister's questions, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll have a bit of that later on. But anyway, what was the decision on the bedroom tax then? What's happening?
It was decided to defer decisions for 3 months.
That sounds like a good idea, because you've got all sorts of reasons why you might not wish to be evicting people. First of all, you have a statutory duty, often the council does, to house them. Do you actually want to pay all the extra costs to go through the courts for an eviction, when actually you may be only talking about maybe £20 or so a week
Often
the
less than that, actually.
Even less than that. And then there are also, it's also the fact that you go to court to evict somebody, and if the judge looks at it and says, well, hang on, you're talking about less than £20 a week, you know, why are you evicting this person? This is social housing. You may not even get your eviction order.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no defender of the bedroom tax, don't get me wrong. I mean, let's not forget, this is a policy that was first brought in for private tenants when it came to housing benefit under the Labour government. But obviously, local authority tenants are that much more vulnerable. But it's the council itself is stuck between a rock and a very hard place, because for various reasons, if they fail to collect that money, then apparently, according to the working group, they could be done. That is technically unlawful. They could be done for fettering their income, and who would sue them for being unlawful? I don't know.
Why is it so often these things end up at the door of the head of legal services, whoever it is that's hovering around, the lawyer that says, oh, well, councillors, you know, unless you decide this way, blah, blah, blah.
I think local authorities have been landed with a pretty unworkable policy. They really have, because, I mean, even if they did evict people, but it would be incredibly costly. And where do these people go? It's not as though there's massive swathes of social housing sitting empty waiting for them. I mean, that is another major point of this that really fails in this policy, is that there simply isn't the local authority or social housing available to rehouse people, even if they said they...
cynical, but isn't it possible that this is also done in order to keep house prices high, because in order to inflate the buy-to-let sector of the housing market?
If you're actually threatening, and actually
in some ways just intimidating people to leave because they can't afford to pay their rent, and they can get paid housing benefit in another place with one less bedroom in the private sector, this is helping the buy-to-let sector, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, because bear in mind that the housing benefit available to them in the private sector won't be particularly high anyway, and in most cases won't meet private renting levels. So it strikes me as being an entirely unworkable policy. Purely, I mean, on ideological grounds, you have your own views, but purely on practical grounds, even, it simply doesn't work, because the cost involved in enforcing it is enormous. There's nowhere for people to go, and of course, you know, ethically, you do wonder about some of the finer points of how this is all going to work and the impact it has on people.
Okay, tell us something positive about the council. What you enjoy doing as a councillor,
everything but full council.
Okay, so what are the things you other committees?
Okay,
do a lot of work in your ward?
Yep. I mean, obviously, my ward is Redland, so there's not a high level of casework. I'm very lucky in that respect, and Redland is a lovely, lovely ward. We've got two fabulous parks in it. I mean, one of my favourite bits of working in Redland is going to Friends of St Andrew's Park meeting, for example. So you meet some wonderful people in Redland who volunteer and spend a huge amount of their time trying to make their local neighbourhood better, and they're, you know, inspirational, lovely people, and I really, really enjoy that. The other committee I was just talking to earlier on, I sit on the Women's Commission, I sit on Children's Service at the Children's Services, I'm chair of PSP, which is Public Safety and Protection, which is essentially taxi drivers, so I oversee that area of things. I sit on the Licensing Committee, Human Resources Committee.
What about the women and the children? What goes
women
on those
children.
Committees?
The Women's Commission was set up by George Ferguson about 6 months ago. We've had three meetings so far, and what we're basically looking to do is to try and improve the Well, there's four main areas that were identified, and I'm trying to remember what they are now, because it is quite new, this one. It's health, women in the economy, women's safety, and there's a fourth, transport. Those are the four areas that have been identified by Bristol Women's Voice as being the area that women are most concerned about. And the moment we're looking at women and their personal safety, and also at transport. Although a quick plug, on the 3rd of October, I think it is, there's two events going on in the city, in City Hall, Council House, whatever. And we're encouraging women to come along to see how they can get more involved in public life. So there might be myself, Daniela Radici and Marge Hickman there representing councillors to try and encourage women that... the women are shamefully underrepresented in the council. There's only 24% of councillors are women, which is clearly not right. 51% of us are women, so something's not working there. So we're trying to encourage as many women as we can to get involved and just go, well, being a councillor, it's really interesting, and it is really interesting. It's really productive. Essentially, most of my job as a councillor is community work rather than being a politician.
But I mean, surely one of the reasons many women don't is simply childcare. They don't think that they have the time.
Yeah, it is tricky. And that's one of the reasons why myself and Daniela, both of whom have primary school age children, we want to be there to explain to people it is actually possible. And also, I mean, it does make me feel slightly cross that childcare is always seen as being a women's issue. Why is it not a man's issue as well? Presumably, in a lot of cases, two parents are involved, but that's another hobby horse. I mean, a lot of meetings, licensing and PSP are at 10 in the morning. There is a bit of evening work. Some meetings start at 2 in the afternoon. Full council alternates between 2 and 6. I mean, it is doable. It's not easy, But it is doable, and you know, you can work your way around it.
Okay, Old Lady Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, let's bring you back to talk a bit about this bedroom tax, because quite clearly a bit of a kerfuffle going on at the City Council about whether they're going to actually evict people who can't pay this tax fee. Over how much is it a week we're talking about?
Ooh, I think it depends. Sorry, over how much a week?
Well, how much money a week? I mean, if someone's in rent arrears by, say, £5-6 a week, would they be evicted still?
Well, at the moment, I think it's been suspended. I mean, let's not forget, the decision is finally George Ferguson, so it's down to him. And at the moment, something like 40%... Well, back in April, it was 40% of council tenants were in arrears, and now it's gone up to 71% since April. So that gives you an idea of the scale of the problem. Nobody is being evicted yet, so I don't know at what point. I think the average arrears at the moment are around 186 quid, something like that.
But I know that any judge in a court will have a look at the amount of money a week that you're not able to pay, and if it's not that much, a judge might well say, well, this isn't a justified case to evict the person. That's quite feasible.
It is possibly feasible. As I said, the council would be acting unlawfully if they didn't make every effort to get this money back.
Vast amounts of money, not evicting people.
I know.
Ridiculous. Martin?
Well, I'm glad to hear Fee thinks it's a ridiculous policy, because so do I, but the Labour leadership are not prepared to come out and say that they'll...
They're making hints at it, aren't they? But they won't make any commitments.
But leaving that aside, I also understand that Conservative members on the council are unhappy with the impact of this. Am I correct in that assumption?
I honestly don't know. I wasn't part of the working group, and also I wasn't part of the group negotiating with the Conservatives. Well, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess what the Tory position on this one is.
Well, I mean, I tend to find that the Tories in Bristol are flexible-minded about things like this, and it could be that Bristol is trying to find a way to make sense of what is actually a ridiculously silly policy.
I think there is a genuine effort to try and act lawfully and protect vulnerable tenants, and at the moment it's looking pretty tricky, I have to say.
Well, I think the point is, I mean, you know, the big questions about what the economy is doing are being drowned out by what is essentially a vindictive and pointless policy. Not the only one, I might add, that's being pushed through. But I mean, it's surely obvious to people that when you've got Help to Buy being pushed by the government, which is essentially subsidising people already on the property ladder to go further up the property ladder to basically build their own personal capital, at the same time as the people at the bottom of the ladder are being told, and often the very vulnerable, to, you know, people with disablements and so on, you're going to lose your... I mean, just think of the mental health issues brought up by this. And it's vindictive, it's class war from the top, and ultimately there'll have to be class war from the bottom.
Martin, what's your solution to all of this then?
Well, first of all, just when you're in a hole,
stop digging. At the moment, we aren't evicting. The Bristol City Council's not evicting people that can't pay the bedroom tax. Well, What would you do to actually alleviate?
They certainly need to look into the legalities of what they can and can't do. Because if you start breaking the law, then you end up paying lots more money to.
And it's clear they run the risk by continuing not to collect that extra money. It's clear that they are potentially acting unlawfully, and they, having had that advice, they can't ignore it. But on the other hand, where do people go? So
what you'd probably want to do is that the officers would take a very, very relaxed view of people who were in arrears, but without making a big stong and fance about it. But of course, ultimately, the elected councillors have got to take a position on this. And of course, even if it was lawful, it would undermine the council's finances, for sure. And the same with the housing associations. They're going to have their finances undermined.
Of course, let's not forget the councillors can take whatever position they wish, but it is still ultimately George Ferguson's decision.
Well, indeed. But I mean, obviously, I mean, I think that, you know, he's on the side of the angels on this one. He regards it as a silly policy, as most sensible people around the country do. I mean, maybe people who are in parties in the coalition, maybe the answer is for them to get on to their, you know, people more senior and say, look, this is a silly policy. I mean, for example, if the Conservatives on the council were to get back to their local MPs and say, look, this is a silly policy, that's probably the most useful thing that they could do.
Well, I do know that Tim Kent, the leader of the Lib Dems, has written to Steve Webb about this, outlining our concerns and saying, look, you know, please.
Anyway, one of the people that Martin will be obviously writing to is Ed Miliband on this one. The only trouble is Ed Miliband's popularity has slumped this week to the lowest level ever. 6 in 10 people, that's 60%, said they were dissatisfied with the Labour leader, while only 24% were satisfied. The Prime Minister is the most likely to be seen to be having sound judgment. 40% compared with 32% for Ed Miliband, 27% for Nick Clegg and 19% for Nigel Farage. These are really awful figures for Miliband. At this point, Martin, really, he's got to be doing better if Labour stand a good chance of winning the next election, hasn't he?
Well, you could say that, and I'm no doubt the press are saying exactly that. I think he's not done a bad job. He's done some things wrong from my point of view, but I didn't expect him to be 100% what I expected him to be. He's got to represent a cross-section of views. I think Tim Farron, who's a fairly senior Liberal Democrat, I can't remember what he is, his party chairman or something.
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yes.
But anyway, he's nodding there. Yeah, yes, he got that right.
But
well done, Martin.
He was saying that, ultimately Ed Miliband is a decent chap and that he's the sort of chap that we as Liberals could do business with in some future coalition, which I think is probably about right. I think people don't care who the leader of the party is. They vote Labour if they're going to vote Labour. Doesn't matter who it is. They vote. All this idea that the leader has to be some kind of charismatic, lantern-jawed chap with a wonderful family. We just want somebody who's competent and doesn't take us to war in Iraq. That'll do.
On the Liberal Democrat side, Nick Clegg's been told today to quit the Lib Dem leadership. This is by a close ally of the business secretary Vince Cable, Matthew Oakeshott. Do you think Nick Clegg's the right person to lead the Lib Dems into the next general election?
I think he's taken a fair bit of flap, and a bit like what you were saying about Ed Miliband, I think he's a decent, honourable person who genuinely believes he's doing the right thing.
So he's not just an ex-PR man who's rather past his sell-by date.
I was about to lead on to something, and it's something you touched on about party leaders being lantern-drawn people with families, and that is the increasing sort of Americanisation of our political world, that party politics is based on your morality and these kind of sound bites and your personality, and you just sit there thinking, this is just superficial trash. It really is. Who cares if you have two?
But isn't he seen as being someone who's very, very close to Cameron? He's kind of brushed up against him, and people will be seeing, for a lot of people that voted Lib Dem, really annoyed about the way that the Lib Dems have not done enough to temper some of the more extreme policies the Conservatives have brought in, and Nick is bound to be associated with that attitude in the party.
I can imagine that a lot of people would feel that way. I mean, the Lib Dems have done some things to temper. I mean, things would be a lot worse if the Tories were allowed free rein. But that is, it's a judgment call. I mean, I genuinely think he's done what he can. But you have to bear in mind, we haven't got that many MPs. I mean, the Tories, there's a lot more people voted Tory than voted Lib Dem. But it's this focus on the personality. I mean, both from Ed Miliband's point of view and from Nick Clegg's point of view, I just find really irritating, I have to say. It's just superficial, and it's a real Americanization the way we view our political world, which I think is unfortunate, because then you end up voting for people purely on the basis of their leader's personality.
But isn't that the fault of the leaders, that they themselves have been sort of painting them out to be these incredibly sort of iconoclastic figures that can change everything? They have also got this kind of PR sheen to them, sort of shiny polished faces, they're at every right correct photo call, etc., and that's one of the reasons that they're becoming a kind of toxic asset, if you want, for the part. Well, not really an asset, but a toxic part of the party. Can you really? a toxic part of these political parties.
I think, generally speaking, in politics, yes, I think there's far too much emphasis on PR and on appearances and on photo opportunities, and it is very unfortunate when quite often there's difficult decisions that have to be made, which aren't particularly glamorous or exciting. And there's a lot of time spent going through huge amounts of papers, but. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in many ways. I think there's far too much PR in politics and not enough actual meat there.
OK, UK unemployment rate drops, hooray. To 7.7%, and this is the BBC. And I've just copied over the graph for you here as well. Since 1982, we're basically coming back up to roughly to the same levels as it was at the high point back in the in the early 1990s. Creeping back up, it's kind of almost levelling out. This is unemployment. Martin is actually going down a little bit, down to 7.7% from about 7.8%.
Well, there's all sorts of dispute about whether the figures represent. I mean, there's two ways of measuring unemployment. One is people who claim benefits, and of course that changes whenever the benefits regulations change, so you can't compare over time. The other way is using the Labour Force Survey, which is essentially like a sort of opinion poll. They ask a cross-section of adults, have you worked in the last 2-3 weeks, and if you haven't, have you looked for work? So people on benefits who haven't looked for work aren't included in that. But of course, we've got people, for example, on working tax credit. I'm thinking of people I know who are on working tax credit who are classified as self-employed, but they're not. They're effectively unemployed. And interestingly, the employment figures showed there's been a 14,000 drop in people employed in manufacturing industry and a 77,000 rise in estate agents.
So we've just recruited
a whole three battalions or nearly a whole division of estate agents, and that is your help to buy. Meanwhile, we're cutting back on frontline social workers, teachers, police officers. That's what we've got.
Okay, Fee, what do you make of these figures? The main thing to look at there, I would say, is the 16 plus unemployment versus the 18 plus. I mean, it looks to me as if the quite consistently, really, since the mid-early 1990s, that youth unemployment has been creeping up. And now, of course, we see the announcement this week as well. Oh, wonderful, we're going to have a debate in Parliament on a bill to reintroduce national service. How convenient.
Yeah, that was news to me. I only heard about that when you handed it to me 5 minutes ago. I mean, on the plus side, we are having quite a few new apprenticeships in and around the Bristol area, and Bristol has been remarkably well unemployment-wise compared to other parts of the country. We've been very, very fortunate. But I agree with you. I think youth unemployment is a real worry. And, there's high levels of very educated young people who've been to university, and they come out and what do they do? And so anybody manages to support themselves at that point, you just think, well, good for you. But it is tricky, but there are more apprenticeships available now.
Martin, this is particularly irksome, isn't it, for young people who are just out of university, just got into their student debt, and they're finding they can't even start to make a dent in repaying it.
Well, we've only just, I mean, let's face it, let's look at the bigger picture here. We've had zero interest rates for 5 years. We've had massive quantitative easing. In other words, they just switched the money tap on 100%, but of course they've been cutting public expenditure at the same time. And as a result, at the end of all of that, we get a slight upward blip. A slight downward blip in unemployment. I suspect, and most of the mainstream don't seem to want to face this, that there's every possibility that there is going to be a further crash. So in other words, we haven't had the crisis yet. What we've had so far is a crisis where the state intervened and propped everything up for 5 years, but the state is now running out of resources. Anything could cause a crisis. Greece could default. There could be a bomb attack in Syria, which sets it all off. I remember the stock market crash in 1987 was set off by the pictures going around the world of an oil rig on fire in the Gulf because it had been hit by an Iranian missile, and suddenly the stock market sold off. That's what triggered 87. So we're right on the cut. I mean, the mainstream financial press keeps saying, "Oh, we've turned the corner." Frankly, we haven't. And the political debate is all about what kind of recovery are we having. And I think what we really need to be thinking about, and I hope the top civil service are very well aware of this, is what are we going to do when the SH1T really hits the fan?
Fee, what are your thoughts about the prospects? I mean, do you think that we're through this recovery? We've had George Osborne saying, "I'm a hero," this week, isn't he? Basically, for once, he wasn't wearing his high-vis jacket. And I always look at that and think he's on must be on a demolition site again, demolishing whatever it is. And he was in an office block that is actually was in mothballs for a while. Then it started to be built again. But he's saying, "I've saved the economy, everyone." Has he?
I have to say, Martin, you're the economist, I'm not. My knowledge of global economics is fairly low, but since you mentioned the whole Syrian thing, it does make me wonder. You just think, we're cutting money left, right and centre, but we seem fairly insouciant, the Tories seem fairly insouciant about dropping a couple of £1 million worth of bombs on Syria.
Each just think in terms of £1.5 million.
I underestimated. There we go. Yeah. But I put my hands up. Quite frankly, my knowledge of global economics is poor.
Well, okay.
And as I was saying earlier,
my area
of expertise does pretty much concern services from the council. As a councillor, your job is mainly involved, as I said, with sorting out services for local people, interacting between the local city council and your local constituents, and there's only a tiny bit of it is politics, and even a tiny bit of that is party politics.
So it's a bit of a fingers crossed. Is it? Maybe it'll go up. Maybe it'll go down.
Not even that, I'm afraid. It's a really, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess. because I'm not an expert and I'd be making something up. I don't really want to make something up about the global economic situation.
Okay, well, thank you for being so frank. It's good to hear. You know, it doesn't happen that often. Right, Royal Mail listing to get the Cabinet go-ahead. This is ministers on Thursday gave the go-ahead for a stock market flotation of Royal Mail. Fee, what do you make of this? Is this something that even Margaret Thatcher balked at, isn't it? You know, we can't privatise that. It's been around for over 300 years and it's a national treasure, a national institution. Very important to keep it under government control, government ownership, and yet no, it's going to be floated on the stock exchange. Yes. Anyone can buy it, the Chinese if they want to, after a few years.
Well, I mean, I've got no particular sort of patriotic thing about, you know, foreigners owning our stamps sort of thing, but I am concerned about this. I mean, it is deeply.
What about
deeply
the Syrians
unpopular.
If they were to buy the post office?
But it's not a. For me, it's not an issue of which country owns it. It is a question of this thought that seems to be going around that the Royal Mail will be somehow liberated to get free to get private investment and everything will be lovely. I mean, if you look at the examples of utilities that have been floated in the past, it's not entirely encouraging, frankly. I mean, you look at the large numbers of people, the members of the public who are against this, and also clearly the numbers of employees who have been told, "But you're lucky, you'll get some shares." I don't think they want shares in Royal Mail, thank you very much. I think the message seems to be coming through loud and clear that they want to carry on as things are. So it's not a decision I entirely understand, to be honest.
Yes, apparently it's going to stay the same. It's going to stay the same for 3 years, apparently, roughly. Right. We won't notice all that much difference, but then anything goes. Martin?
Well, the most interesting thing, this from my point of view, is that the pension liabilities of Royal Mail have been taken over by the government. So this isn't really an honest privatisation. So all of the liabilities to pay pensions to the existing workforce and previous workforces over many, many years, that's going to be taken over by the government. And then what's left will be privatised so that the profits can be made by whoever buys it. So in other words, we are all going to, as collectively, pick up the pensions of the post office workers, and the people who come in to buy it won't have to worry about that at all. If you're genuinely privatising it, they have to buy those liabilities as well as the assets. And then at that point they say, well, we can't make this pay. It's like, no, you can't, can you? That's why these things are utilities in the public sector. The Labour Party will not... The way it's shaping up, I think the CWU will vote to strike. They're not allowed to strike against privatisation because of Thatcher's regulations. I mean, the rest of Europe they would be, but not in Britain. So they're going to have ostensibly a strike about pay. They've just had, it's an 8% pay increase, and they're hoping to sweeten them with that. But I think most postal workers are well aware that that's a sweetener, and they're going to vote to strike over pay as a means of trying to scupper the privatisation. But that won't really work unless they can build support in rural communities who are particularly going to lose out. Yeah, they need to build into the Tory shires. The Communications Workers Union needs to go out and talk to people in rural areas, you know, the Isle of Skye, whatever, and say, look, you're the people who are going to lose out here. Will you back us if we strike? And they've got to work quite hard to get that. And then, you know, maybe Tory backbenchers, like with the forest issue, will start to come forward and say, hang on a minute, our local post office is in the firing line here. This is what we're talking about.
But it's not the post office, this is the Royal Mail, which is does all the sort of back-end,
well,
the sorting
side. The implications are...
That's one of the reasons they've separated the two, isn't it?
Yes, I know, but the implications are that that will all be allowed to wither. That's the whole
point.
So
is there any problem, you know, but with a commercial industry, a company, TNT, or one of these commercial companies just coming in and saying, well actually,
they're going to keep the universal service obligation. Now, if you're going to keep the universal service obligation, it's not really terribly profitable. So they're going to push to get rid of that. I mean, even in the United States of America, where everything's private, the post office isn't. Just isn't.
Billy Hayes was saying on the radio yesterday, this is just simply selling it off to their mates in the city. This is what the Conservatives always wanted to do. But the fact of the matter is, this is Vince Cable's little plan. He's a Lib Dem. So are the Lib Dems also have mates in the city that they like to feather their nest? Because another side of all this is that the money that the government are getting in this sell-off is there to help pay off the deficit and to make the deficit look better at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not intimate with many high-flying Lib Dems in Westminster, to be perfectly honest. So their relationships with high-flying city mates in London is...
What about Vince? What do you make of him? I mean, is he sold out here?
I don't know. I mean, usually Vince's judgment is something which is, you know, which he values. But I think I have to say, I agree with you that I think that if this is going to be stopped, then it is going to be the Tories in the shires because Conservatives have been saying things like, well, if you want to live in the countryside, then you must pay a premium for doing so, and you should expect to pay a premium postwise and all this kind of thing. And I can't imagine this going down too well with the kind of Tory heartlands. So it'll be interesting to see how the rural county types do react to this, because
yeah, well,
I think they
the CWU
are going to
have got to build out to those people.
Exactly. Yeah,
they can't just rely on calling their members out on strike because they concentrate in the urban areas.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, up to Westminster now, and we'll start this week by going to Prime Minister's Questions, where Nadine Dorries was asking a question about aborting female babies.
Nadine Dorries.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, despite having enough evidence to prosecute, the CPS chose not to proceed and prosecute doctors in Britain offering to abort a baby because it was a female. Yeah. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that this is very uncomfortable, that in fact the 67 Act is now almost obsolete and puts our abortion policy on a par with India and China, and a female fetus in the womb today is more vulnerable than she was last week?
No, I think my honourable friend is absolutely right to raise this, and let's be clear that abortions on the basis of a child's sex are wrong and illegal in our country. And I think the Daily Telegraph is to be commended for the campaign and the work that they've done to highlight this important case. But in our country, we do have independent prosecuting authorities. It's very important that they look at the evidence and they make a decision on the basis of likelihood of getting a conviction and the public interest in making a case and taking it to court. That's how things have to work in our country, but I share her concern about what we've read and what has happened, and it's absolutely right that professional action should be considered as well.
Bit of an emotive topic, Fee, but abortion always is. But, I mean, this is pretty shocking, isn't it? If there is evidence that a fetus has been aborted because it was a female, should there be prosecutions?
Well, it looks to me as though, I mean, yes, obviously there should be a prosecution, but it looks to me as though there is, I haven't read the Telegraph article. I'm not a regular Telegraph reader, it'll astonish you to learn. But it looks that the issue here, on the surface of it, is that there wasn't sufficient evidence to do so. And clearly, having a politician intervening in the processes of a court is very, very dodgy ground to go on. So it seems to me this is an issue about the efficiency of the Crown Prosecution Service rather than an issue of the legality or otherwise of aborting female or indeed disabled fetuses. I mean, obviously, it's a selective abortion is a very, very emotive subject, but it seems to me the law seems fairly clear. It's the way in which it was or wasn't enacted. And without knowing the details of the evidence available on that case, I can't really comment.
Okay, Martin.
And clearly, it's completely wrong, but it's the...
I thought we'd got rid of this process 60 years ago, this kind of thing, but obviously we don't know the ins and outs of why. But there's been a lot of problems with the Crown Prosecution Service, particularly, we saw on the television last night the CPS refusing to prosecute Cyril Smith, even though there was quite a lot of evidence that he was a paedophile. That was in last night's Dispatches programme. So what do you make on the principle here, first of all, about female fetuses being aborted?
Well, I mean, it is illegal to abort fetuses because they are female. I think that's quite clear. The question is this what happened in this case? Now, I imagine that what tends to happen in these cases is that there are other reasons which are given. I mean, the parents may, in the back of their minds, for example, say, we don't want a female child, but they don't give that as the reason. They say, well, we don't want a child because we can't afford
it. Well, so should parents be told what the sex of their child
is
in that case?
Well, I think this is why it's become such a problem in places like India, because in the past people didn't know. Mm. They just didn't know, so they couldn't abort on that basis. Now, of course, people in India, sort of middle class families, are able to assess whether they're getting a boy or a girl, and it means a hell of a lot in India. You know, if you get a girl, you've got to find a dowry for them and all the rest of it. And
it's
this
a
whole,
financial decision.
Yeah, the dowry system never. Poor people never used to care about what sex their children were. They didn't know. They didn't care. They didn't bother about it. But it's now gone right down the social scale in India, where people are worried because they will have to find a dowry for a female child, but they won't have to find a dowry for a male child. And of course, there's a massive imbalance building up. The same thing has happened in China because of the one-child policy. People are basically getting rid of female children because they're... And of course, you've now got a massive imbalance developing in the Chinese population. You're going to have a lot of very frustrated teenage boys.
What are your thoughts about this social engineering? That's what it seems like, certainly what Martin's saying in other countries, and if, especially if it's to do with a financial decision as to whether a fetus lives or dies. This is pretty scary stuff.
It is very scary stuff, and I think that discrimination takes many, many forms, really, and I mean, obviously, I've never actually been to China or indeed to India, but these are the unintended consequences in China, especially of the one-child policy, which does have its plus points, but It is basically sexist discrimination.
But I mean, David Attenborough, a good old BBC fellow, was saying earlier this week, oh, we're going to have to start being responsible in Britain and never have more than two children. What are your thoughts on that, Fi?
I think that you do need to take a certain amount of responsibility.
He's saying the population of the world is too big. We've got too many people. I mean, I just find this really irritating because I don't think it's anything to do with the actual number of the population. It's to do with the way food is distributed so unfairly. You know,
I think many people have a fundamental problem about being dictated to by the state about such a kind of intimate level of their personal life. I think people could do with stopping and thinking a little bit about the impact that they have, you know, having lots of children has on the outside world, but generally speaking, it's such a personal decision that many, and especially when many people are struggling to have children full stop, it's one of those general sort of social things which is completely different from one country to the next. You know, in the West, we kind of agonise about how many rounds of IVF do we have on the NHS, whereas in other countries, it's too many children that you... And basic contraception isn't available. I mean, for a lot of women in India and various other places, it's not a choice for how many children you have because they don't have access to reliable contraception. Should, and even if they do, they have to do so secretly.
Should David Attenborough go and live in China? Maybe.
I don't know. How many children has David Attenborough got?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
we need to Wikipedia him up. Martin, what are your thoughts about David Attenborough and his saying that anyone that has more than two children in Britain is it being irresponsible?
Well, I think those who say that population isn't a problem are deluding themselves. I mean, they come in two varieties usually. They're either free marketeers who just believe that capitalism is such a wonderful system that it doesn't matter how many children you have because, you know, the Malthusian limits on population are easily overcome by technological changes and so on. And that the Marxist version of that is similar. And as a previous pope says, with every mouth, the Lord provides a pair of hands. Now, all of that is kind of true because, in actual fact, there is no absolute limit to the level of population. It depends on your level of technology and so on and stuff like that. So to say that there's too many people is just too simplistic. But on the other hand, to say that population isn't a problem, I think, is basically hiding head in the sand. The Chinese Communist Party decided to have the one-child policy, wasn't it, in the 80s. Previous to that, Mao Zedong's policy was we want to breed as many little soldiers as possible so that we can send our human wave attacks as they did in Korea, where the Chinese, I was watching this thing about the Battle of the Imjin River, where the Gloucesters were fighting with the Chinese, and the Chinese just sent, you know, basically human wave attacks. You know, we've got plenty of people, and the policy of China was, you know, we're going to have so many people that our armies will overwhelm everybody. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party at the end of that said, hang on a minute, we're already, you know, 6 billion, you know, 1 billion and growing. One in four people in the world lives in the People's Republic of China.
Anyway, David Attenborough has only had two children, but he himself was the middle of three sons. So I don't know whether his parents...
You can hardly hold him responsible for his parents.
No, I know, no. But, I mean, maybe he should take voluntary harakiri.
I think we need to also watch a little bit for a bit of hidden racism as well, because there is that thing about, oh, you know, Indians, Africans, they all have too many children. Somalis, why do they have so many children?
They consume a lot less resources than we do.
And it wasn't that long ago that, you know, in Victorian times, there was a lot of... It was only 100 years or so ago when it was perfectly normal and respectable here in the UK to have lots of children. That was simply what you did because you needed plenty of people to support you in your older age. So it's the kind of them and us thing, which I find quite uncomfortable. You
know, okay, another story this week. Nigel Evans, the Deputy Speaker, has been charged with 7 counts of rape and resigned his job as Deputy Speaker, quite obviously. So let's have a listen to him before and after his arrest this week on those 7 counts of rape.
My name is Nigel Evans. I'm Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons and I'm proud to be gay. I know a lot of young people face pressures as far as coming out to their family and friends, and I had the same problem. I joke that when I was growing up in Swansea, it was bad enough coming out as a conservative, never mind coming out as gay. But the fact is that when I came out, and it was only, 7 months ago, I had a lot of letters, emails, Facebook messages, and the vast majority of them, over 99%, were incredibly supportive. It was a difficult journey for me because I'm in politics and I thought that it would make my progress that much more difficult. But the fact is that I've had huge support from the Prime Minister David Cameron and the Speaker of the House of Commons John Bercow, and indeed all my colleagues from all parties and persuasions within the House of Commons.
Personal statement, Mr. Nigel Evans. Yeah.
I hope that my right honourable and honourable friends will bear with me during this personal statement. It's been a few years since I made a speech in this chamber, and I'm sad to say that this is the speech. As many of you will know, following recent allegations, I was charged with alleged offences yesterday. I now have the opportunity to robustly defend my innocence and seek acquittal. I've therefore decided that the best course of action is for me to return to the backbenches, and this is a decision that I've made myself after careful consideration. I did not have the Conservative whip as Deputy Speaker, and I'm not seeking its return until after the conclusion of events. I will sit as an independent Member of Parliament for the Ribble Valley. It was one of the happiest days of my life when I was elected Deputy Speaker in 2010. It was an endorsement of my abilities to do the job by my colleagues, and for that I am grateful. Since these allegations, I've not been able to fully fulfil my duties in the chair, which left me in a land of limbo. None of us were elected to the fine office of Member of Parliament to be put in that invidious position, unable to fully fulfil the reason why we were sent here.
Now, this is pretty shocking stuff, again, Fee. Someone in such an important position has had to withdraw from it, been accused of 7 counts of rape. Pretty scary. I mean, obviously, we don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. You know, he'll get himself a fair trial. But it does rather drag politics through the mire, doesn't it, when people who are supposed to be in such positions of responsibility are accused of such horrendous crimes.
Yes, I mean, who knows what actually happened, and I think it's probably wrong to jump to any conclusions about whether as to his guilt or innocence. I suppose, I mean, there are, 700 MPs? So out of those people, there are going to be some who are not white in the white, but he clearly made the right decision withdrawing, because I wouldn't be on the ball if he's going through this kind of trial.
And Martin, I mean, it's just, I mean, the point I'm trying to make, I suppose, by looking at this story, is it doesn't actually endear the public to politicians when you get these such horrendous accusations against people who supposedly have public trust.
Well, as Fee says, he's not been found guilty yet. Let's find out whether it's true or not. I mean, let's not jump to any conclusions. What I do find a bit unusual is him being allowed to make a statement to Parliament. That's actually, as I understand it, that's not usual. Statements to Parliament, like when Robin Cook resigned, for example, there was a political reason for him to make his statement about resigning from the government. This is a personal matter, and he's actually abusing parliamentary privilege there by using Parliament as a place to defend himself before he goes to court. What he should have done is resigned and gone to court, in my view. And what I'm unhappy about is he's using the privilege of parliamentary protection to sort of defend himself when he shouldn't have been given the 5 minutes to speak, basically.
Okay, Prime Minister's questions now. Tom Clark asked a question on Wednesday of David Cameron about the mentally ill in police cells.
Mr. Tom Clark.
Mr. Speaker, can the Prime Minister tell us why people with mental illnesses are being kept in police cells?
Well, we are making efforts to try to bring that to an end by better working between the NHS and the police. This has been a long-standing problem under governments of all colours for a very long time, but we're having those discussions to try and make good progress.
Well, not much of an answer there, Fee, but, I mean, this is an increasing problem, and put very, very succinctly and sharply there, in the Commons. What are your thoughts about police cells? Are they the right place for mentally ill people?
Clearly not. I think that the provision for people with mental health problems is often poor, and the problem is that quite often, I mean, as you know, I work for Stephen Williams, and we get a lot of casework, and many people who come to see him are people who have quite severe mental health problems. They have paranoia, they're bipolar, whatever, but there's nowhere for them to go. That clearly there's a lot of people who aren't capable of looking after themselves and are causing problems for their neighbours, and their neighbours will come and say they're worried about their next door neighbour because they know they're not well, and they're clearly distressed and they're clearly ill, but they're not quite ill enough to be sectioned, and and treated adequately. So there's a big, big middle ground of people who are distressed, who are in pain, who are causing antisocial behaviour, who are having antisocial episodes through no fault of their own. I mean, they're ill. If you had a broken leg, you wouldn't.
But they're kind of thrown on the scrap heap, aren't they? This whole business of care in the community. Well, they're in the community, but there ain't no care.
Well, I think that social workers and people do what they can. But obviously, I mean, people with mental health, I mean, a common complaint that we get is that people, they go through from crisis. They go through crisis, they get sectioned, they get better, they get released into the community, then the care ebbs away until once again they hit crisis. And I think we do need more continuity rather than kind of crisis management of people with mental health problems. And and what is actually quite heartening is that quite often it is neighbours of people who've got quite severe mental health problems who come along and say, someone should be looking after them. And I know, and they're suffering from noise and antisocial behaviour themselves, but they're sympathetic and they want to help and they don't know where to go because
so where do
that
they
huge
go?
Middle ground. Well, they come to their MP, they go to social workers, but often if there's a big, big level between not being well enough to look after yourself but still being too well to be looked after by somebody else, then there's lots of people who are in a bit of a state from
Yeah, well, that's terrible, isn't it? Because it means that nobody's looking after you and you're just getting worse and worse.
And then you hit crisis point and then, bang, you get sectioned. That kind of yo-yo treatment can't be working for many people.
No care. Lots of community, but no care, Martin.
Well, I think that mental health is a big Cinderella, isn't it, in our society? Yeah. Nobody seems to take it seriously. And so, for example, ATOS, when they were deciding whether people were fit for work or whatever, it's to do simply with, can you walk 10 yards? Can you, type a keyboard?
Can you pick up a pound coin? That's another one.
Yes, but I mean, but it may be that you think that somebody's in real mental distress there. And, of course, it should be recognised. Employers don't want people on their payroll who have got mental health issues. Now, of course, that's discrimination in some respects. I mean, people should be helped back into the workforce by all means. But the whole attitude towards people, I mean, lots of people have mental health issues in their lives. Yeah. It's not a minority. Yeah. It's a large, large section of people in the society at some time in their lives have mental health issues. Yeah. We've all been there when we've been in trauma and upset, and therefore we should all have sympathy for those who are in such circumstances.
Yeah. I think attitudes have improved enormously. When you've got the likes of Stephen Fry, for example, declaring quite freely that he is bipolar. Yeah. And Carrie Fisher as well, she's bipolar. And there is more acceptance and there is more understanding, but my God, there's a long way to go because people are still, in the main, frightened of people who behave oddly. And they unreasonably fear attack. I mean, as you all know, you're far more likely to be attacked by a family member than by a person in the street. But it is people with mental health problems in the street that people are frightened of. And it's things have progressed, but we really aren't there yet. And there is a stigma and there's a fear. And as you quite rightly say, Martin, this is a Cinderella issue. And also because it's very hard to quantify. Like I said, if you have a broken leg, fairly obvious you've got a broken leg. You can't necessarily go to
sort
work.
Sort of pull yourself together syndrome.
Yeah, and there is still that thing with mental health issues. Pull yourself together, you're not trying hard enough. And also with ATOS assessments, clearly a lot of mental health symptoms, they come and go, they're up and down. It's cyclical. So if you happen to go on your ATOS assessment on a good day, then you're stuffed. You know, if you, paradoxically, if you kind of go in on a really bad day and have a horrible time and get very distressed, you're more likely to get the assistance you need.
The police use more of tasers, more than doubles in 2 years this week, we hear. The use of the stun guns by police officers in England and Wales more than doubled over the 2 years, according to official figures. Incidents of taser use has risen by 3,128 deployments in 2009 to 6,649 in 2010 and nearly 7,900 in 2011, the Home Office revealed. So doubled in more than 2 years. Fee, what do you make of a taser? Is it actually a useful thing for a police officer, or is it basically potentially going to kill someone? It has killed people. And what do you think of the deployment of tasers over the last few years as they've rolled out and are now being used more than ever?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, but I would trust Amnesty on this one, quite frankly, because they do tend to know their onions when it comes to police behaviour. I mean, I think the jury is still out on that chap who doused himself with petrol, isn't he? They're not too sure whether he'd ignited himself first or whether the taser did it, are they? So I think it's probably best to leave that one on one side. But it's clearly scary. I don't know how effective they are. I don't know what the stats are. But if Amnesty is saying that it's a bit worrying, then I'm worried too.
And there's also where a blind man was shot with a taser because a police officer thought that his white cane was a samurai sword.
Well, at least he didn't have a gun on him.
He didn't die, but he did say it felt like having 50,000 volts straight through his head. Martin, what are your thoughts about these? I must admit, I see these as really effectively. These are the cattle prods which are used in abattoirs, brought out on the street and turned into a little gun, so a policeman can shoot such a thing however many hundreds of yards at you wants to.
Well, the question of the legitimate use of force by the police is going to be constantly interrogated, isn't it? It's going to be constantly interrogated. I mean, we know that hundreds of young people have died in police custody over the last few years in this country, and nobody has ever, hardly ever, been held accountable. Now, I'm willing to accept that some of those were accidents, some of those were whatever, but they can't all be accidents. And this is what causes a great deal of bitterness, particularly in the black community. Mark Duggan's shooting in Tottenham a couple of years ago led to all sorts of disorder and 5 deaths. The police have just got to get this right, and they've got to be seen to get it
right. So have they got it right when they're deploying tasers?
Patently, there is an issue that needs to be resolved here.
I think you have a point, actually, Martin. When there are issues around deaths in custody which don't appear to be transparently investigated, then it benefits nobody, really. It leads to a lack of trust in the police, which makes people suspicious of, or more suspicious than they might otherwise be, of any kind of use of force
and then the danger of disorder is thereby encouraged.
Now, they've been called non-lethal weapons, but they're killing people. I mean, if you've got a heart condition, for example, you've got a pacemaker, it could quite easily, almost definitely kill you at 50,000 volts through you.
Mm. Well, British police always used to police by having enough people to overpower people who were problematic. So you go on demonstrations in Britain and you're surrounded by police. You go on demonstrations in other European countries, the CRS are sort of, 150 yards down the road, and they just fire tear gas at you. The police policy here was always to have enough people to do whatever you needed to do so that you don't, in fact, have to use excessive force.
Do you think a taser is excessive, Fee?
I guess it depends on the individual circumstances. I mean, as I said, at least the police aren't armed with guns as they are in so many other countries, which is slightly reassuring. But on the other hand, if they are being misused...
We've had 7 deaths in 10 years tasers in Britain.
I didn't know that.
I mean, these are... They started to use these tasers in a special way where they take the... what happens is when you fire the thing, it sends out a little bit of metal. I think it's a couple of wires, isn't it? And that puts the 50,000 volts through you. What you can do is actually detach the wires and then press that 50,000 volts directly into the person's skin. Now, that, to me, has absolutely no difference from the cattle prods which are used in an abattoir to steer cows towards, their final moments. And I just find these things absolutely abhorrent. I know there was a documentary probably 20 years ago about BAE Systems now, British... I think it was BAE at the time. But anyway, they were selling these cattle prods to the Saudi Arabians and other Middle Eastern regimes. There was a big hoo-ha about it. And to the Chinese, yeah. But now we're seeing these being regularly deployed on our streets, and many more policemen are carrying them as a regular standard thing.
Well, the police need to be transparent and accountable. Is they do a very difficult job. It'd be interesting to hear Kevin from the Police Federation's view on tasers, because we've had him on several times. I'd be interested to hear what he has to say about it.
Okay. Stricter rules finally on term time holidays will see the cost of family getaways go up. Do you think this is right, Fee? People should be charged if they take their kids on holiday during the term?
Yeah, it's 60 quid, isn't it? Frankly, I've got 2 children, and one in primary, one in secondary school. Not that I would do it myself, of course, being a responsible parent, but even so, if you're taking your kids away, it's going to be a lot more than £60 more expensive to take them away in half term or summertime holidays. So I guess if you can afford to take your kids away to Torremolinos, then you're just going to...
I think you probably save money by actually paying the fine and going away out of school holidays.
Yeah, I mean, my mum took me and the kids to Lanzarote, and it was £3,000 for the 4 of us in half term and £2,000 outside of half term. That's £1,000 saving.
Crikey.
So, yeah, exactly. That was my mum, I'd like to point out. But yeah, that just gives you an idea of the kind of extra charges which are charged for going during the holiday times. And frankly,
Is this right or wrong, Martin?
Well, I haven't really got a strong opinion on it.
Okay.
You've sprung it on me.
Fine. No, I haven't. I gave you that piece of paper about an hour ago. I haven't sprung it on you. Anyway, final bit of news, good bit of news. The Bristol Pound is to be accepted on first buses in the city. Great to finish on a positive note. Anyway, that's all. We've been joined by Fee Hance, who's the Redland councillor, Lib Dem councillor. After the news, Syria and more.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live. from the Sky News Centre.